You are very welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. It is the 22nd of November. The Investec Champions Cup pool stages are complete. The Six Nations starts next week. So there's plenty to get through. Bernard Jackman and Johnny Murphy are with me this morning to get through as much of that as we can. To recap, Connacht made a clean sweep of the Challenge Cup. They beat Cardiff with a bonus point win last Friday. They face Cardiff again in the round of 16. And as top seeds, they will be at home all the way through to the semi-final should they get there. In the Champions Cup, Leinster survived a brief scare against Bath, but they were 47-21 winners in the end. Home to Harlequins next and home for a quarter and semi-final if it applies. Munster away to La Rochelle in the last 16, beaten by Northampton Saints 34-32, but took two losing bonus points in what was probably the game of the round. And then Ulster 52-24 winners against Exeter. Incredibly, they make it through to the next round, although they are away again to Bordeaux Begle, who demolished the Sharks 66 points to 12. Literally just the minute we were about to start recording this podcast, the kickoff details have come through for the last 16 games in the Champions Cup. Leinster will be at home to Harlequins at Croke Park, believe it or not. 3 p.m. kickoff on Saturday, the 5th of April, and that game will be live on RT2 and RT Player. And then later that evening, 5:30 kickoff Irish time, 6:30 local time, is going to be La Rochelle against France at Stade Marcel de Flandre. And then on Sunday, Ulster have got the dreaded early Sunday kickoff, which nobody really likes. 1:30 p.m. local time, 12:30 p.m. Irish time, away to Bordeaux Begle. Guys, I suppose to start with the main reaction we had, a little bit of surprise there, Bernard, that Leinster and Quinns is going to be at Croke Park. Like, we've seen them sell out big games, the Champions Cup semi-final last year, Munster at home this year in the league. They're two very, very big games. A last 16 game at Croke Park. It's going to be interesting to see how many tickets they can ship for that.
Yeah, it is. They've done a great job of filling Croke Park or getting big crowds into it when they stepped up. And obviously, they're well used to putting big numbers in the Aviva as well. But yeah, I heard last week they were looking at Croke Park, but I think it would be a hard sell to fill it. But I suppose it's something that they'll relish the opportunity and challenge to do it. And obviously, it is something different. It's becoming a little bit more common now because of Northampton last year, Munster obviously earlier this year. But there is a novelty factor to be able to go to watch a rugby game at Croke Park. And yeah, I'll be interested to see how many they get. For me, it's not a glamour. Leinster got so lucky with the draw. Now, they obviously had a high ranking, so they deserved it, but it's a very soft draw all the way to the final, you would think.
Yeah, and like that kind of has happened with the draw where it's become a little bit lopsided just through the way the rankings have gone. The Munster had, Johnny, 5:30 Irish time on the Saturday evening, which is, that's the nice time. I think a lot of people enjoy that time, spectators and players. You did grimace when I mentioned Ulster, 12:30 p.m. Irish time, 1:30 local on the Sunday. I've heard it so many times from players down the years, like that is, it's just a kickoff time you don't like. Can you explain what it is about that kickoff time? Sorry, that players just really, yeah, really dislike.
Yeah, it's just in terms of your preparation for for the day. Like, your pre-match is kind of your breakfast. You get up, you have your breakfast, you say go for a walk through, and then you go back for your pre-match, and you're not really even that hungry. It's just kind of you're eating for the sake of it. So it's all that stuff that associated with that early stage, the early mornings, and you just kind of it can come on you very quickly. It's just one that I never particularly liked. Just around, everything that you're prep, that kind of 2:30, 3 time is probably prime what you want on a Saturday or a Friday night. Is kind of, they're the kind of prime ones for me. But yeah, it's just the sleep, everything. It just kind of, you're kind of, and particularly just the food and stuff, it just kind of messes with your routine completely. So, but look, it's one that you're there, and if you draw it, you just have to get on with it.
Burch, did you have a preferred kickoff time when you were playing?
Yeah, Friday nights, get 2 days off of the weekend, Saturday, Sunday. If you played well, if you got a win, If not, you're in on Sunday. But no, Friday nights were nice. There wasn't as many Sunday early kickoffs when I was playing. That's a relatively new thing. But no, even as a TV commentator or pundit, just going to those early games, they often tend to be quite dead, you know, because the
Yeah.
fans struggle to get going as well. But look at the pros, and they gotta play. I taught during COVID when there was a bit of Monday night rugby. You remember that? And
That
Tuesday
was
night
great for a
rugby.
little while, yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I enjoyed that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I enjoy. Now I love playing it, but
It's obviously it's probably like it's obviously a tough sell now when, you know,
yes,
when you're trying to get supporters in, when it
no,
was empty
sure,
grounds and it was just an ideal opportunity to put something on TV on a Monday night, I
yeah,
really, really liked it.
same here, same here.
Right, we'll move through, like it kind of leads us into the discussion around the Champions Cup in general. And I suppose the big one was, like, if you're talking about exposing flaws in the tournament format, like, apologies to Ulster fans. Obviously, I'm sure so many of them are delighted that they went through and deserved to go through. Obviously, they hammered Exeter on Friday night, 52-24. But obviously, it's the second time in 3 seasons now where Ulster, as an example, have qualified with just one win. Munster qualified with one win and one draw last season. It does expose the tournament format a bit, Bernard, where teams are qualifying off the back of one victory. And to be honest, I think the big one is last Wednesday on this podcast, we spoke about Ulster and the potential for them to qualify. And we said that the concerning thing for the tournament was it did, like, even if you're looking at the massive points difference swing that had to be made, both of us said it wasn't a, it wouldn't have been a particular shock for them to qualify.
Yeah, no, you played last week, Neil, and that's the issue. Ulster, all they have to do is get enough points to qualify, and it's not their fault. And you could argue that Richie, I suppose, managed the whole thing really well. You know, obviously resting players against Toulouse, bit stronger against Bordeaux, but didn't get the result, and then were able to win that derby game against Connacht, which was massive for them, and then to be able to beat Exeter. Obviously lost to Leicester Tigers, but beat Exeter and get through. I wonder though, realistically, would it be better for them to make the Challenge Cup? Like I think you put them into that Challenge Cup pot, they have a chance, just the way their youngsters are developing, of potentially being there or thereabouts in that. Whereas, like, obviously anything can happen, but realistically, it's very hard to see anything but a heavy defeat away to Bordeaux, given how the home game went and given how impressive Bordeaux are with any opportunity to have. So but yeah, the competition, it'll only start to heating up now, really. And even with that, it's probably the quarterfinal stages before we probably get more competitive games.
Yeah, it is. And Johnny, like, it kind of, it seems no, like, nobody on either side of the draw seems to be particularly, well, Leinster fans will be delighted, I'm sure, with the potential path that they have. But, you know, a lot of people have pointed out, for example, that Toulouse won all four games of their campaign. They won three of those with bonus points. They racked up an enormous score. But just by virtue of the fact that Bordeaux won four bonus points out of four, they finish ahead of them. Toulouse are the fifth seed. And Bordeaux, who finished just 1 point behind them, or Bordeaux, sorry, our first seed, Toulouse, our fifth seeds, and they never got a chance to play against Bordeaux. And then the flip side of that is for someone like Ulster or the Sharks, they might say, well, you know, we had to play both Toulouse and Bordeaux. Toulouse and Bordeaux didn't have to play each other.
Yeah, it's just, you know, getting out of a series winning one game, you know, into that last round is just, you know, gone are the days of where, you know, even if you won four, you know, you were a runner up at a pool if you won four or six games in some instances in the previous format. And I think it does allude to what Bert said, to for management to be really, you know, to really think about their selection and how they rotate players, which can then also devalue, you know, players going away or, you know, games, pool stage games, because, you know, teams have rotated and they're targeting, you know, an inter-pro game and then targeting one big win at home to try and see what you can do if you pick up enough bonus points. So, and look, that's a management's right within the nature, but I do think it does slightly devalue the last, you know, the overall competition and particularly the kind of history of what was those you know, those pre-Christmas back-to-back games where your group was decided, and then if you'd only won two of those, you're going in, and you probably needed at least 8, if not 10 points to get out of your pool as a, you know, as one of the runners up. So yeah, it just does devalue it slightly. And then management are just doing what they can to manage their teams and get as many points as they can to put them in a situation to get out. But yeah, it's something. And then last year it hasn't happened as much, but you know, in the Challenge Cup it has with Connacht playing Cardiff. Again, there was a lot of kind of teams on this playing each other, which again, it's not necessarily that ideal either.
Yeah, there was a stage on Saturday evening, for example, where if results, I think, had gone according to plan on Sunday, you were probably looking at, I think, three repeat matches from pool stage games like you had
Yeah.
last season. It's really interesting, though, Bernard, looking at the, if you're trying to map out your way to the final at this stage, I think most people would give Leinster a comfortable favourites tag against Harlequins, then Glasgow or Leicester in the quarter final. Again, you'd expect Leinster with home advantage to be winning that. On the other side, most likely Northampton coming through to a semi-final. Northampton or Claremont, I would say, given the home advantage there. But then on the other side, like obviously Toulouse have looked incredible so far, but when you look at the amount of French teams that are over on that other side of the draw, like I think if Toulouse and Leinster were to play tomorrow, I might be backing Toulouse to win. But you could feasibly see Toulon beating Toulouse at home in a one-off game, for example, or Bordeaux being able to knock off Toulouse in a one-off game, or La Rochelle as well. It's,
Yeah.
you know, it's not straightforward whatsoever for Toulouse to get back to that final before they have a chance to actually win the tournament.
Yeah, look at on form, it's those French teams you've mentioned and Leinster. Realistically, you know, it's hard to make a case for any of the teams on the right hand side of the draw as it is on paper, Leinster side, really, bar Leinster. So the fact that they have to, I suppose, navigate through that, the risk obviously involved of playing, you know, strong teams, and the fact that they're teams that they're very used to in the top 14, and the level of impact the top 14 can have. You know, obviously we saw Toulouse a couple of weeks ago rest players to go to La Rochelle because of a trip to Sharks. But in general, you know, in general, it's very difficult to rotate as much in the top 14 as it potentially is as in the URC. Even the Premiership, you know, with no relegation, they don't. It's not the same pressure. But the reality is, I don't think any English teams are genuine contenders at the moment, and it's disappointing to see. You know, I thought they'd be better given the fact that those three clubs went out of business, and they are, you know, Bath obviously benefit greatly from Worcester's demise and Wasps, etc. But realistically, when you get deep into their squad, the salary cap restrictions means that the talent is spread across what, eight clubs, and then you have Newcastle kind of very weak. But that doesn't gear them up to be able to compete with the Toulons, the Bordeaux, the Leinsters, the Toulouses, you would say at the moment.
I'm sure Leinster fans will be hoping to sit back and watch all those teams on the other side of the draw beat each other up for a few weeks and then get down to the business end of the competition. Going through the games, I might start with Ulster just because I'm conscious of the fact that you can kind of end up coming across a little bit harsh talking about how they're scraping through to the knockout stage and exposing the flaws in the competition. But they went out on Friday night, Johnny, and like, they had a job to do. They had to beat Exeter with a bonus point and put up a decent score. And they did that. And now they have a solid degree of confidence coming into a very, very winnable run of games in the URC. Zebre, Benetton, Scarlets, Dragons up to Stormers at home at the end of the Six Nations. You can see now where they can start to gather momentum towards the business end of the season.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that they, you know, first of all, you recognize the shift that the supporters put in on Friday night. Like, the place was packed. You know, it was a real old school Ravenhill feel to it. And, you know, even going, you know, two scores down after kind of five, you know, after that 12, 13-minute period, you're like, oh, here we go. But they grind it out. You know, I think Timoney, Zichuku, you know, and even, you know, the offload pass away it had, those guys are growing and growing and growing. And as well as then the experience of Cooney coming off the bench, they closed that game out really, really well. And they played some really good stuff. Like, it was really enjoyable to watch. Look, they had a job to do. They did it. And I think the big thing, and it was said on commentary, I think Stephen Ferris said it was, a big thing was that, they were dying in the last 15 to 20 minutes of games over the last period. And it's been a hard period for, some results have been very hard for the supporters, but they kind of put the foot down a bit, in the last 30 minutes and really kind of kicked on, which was great to see. And, the experience of going to Bordeaux, it's going to be another big experience for those younger guys in that squad. Could the experience of a Challenge Cup and being potential contenders and winning something might be better for them, but you take what you get. But they do have a really good run of games now to really consolidate themselves in the top half of the URC and really put themselves in proper kind of, chasing that kind of home court, those home knockout phases of your C. So, and it's starting to come together for them. Like, they were really enjoyable to watch in terms of their play and what they do. And then they have the physical attributes of Timoney Izochukwu, and those lads have points of difference, which, you can really layer on from an attacking perspective.
And it's one of those things where obviously they're very rough around the edges still as they're trying to build up that consistency, and it's a very, very young team that Richie Murphy's now dealing with. But when they're out there playing, and when they look like they're enjoying themselves, they are a very enjoyable team to watch when the things are clicking, particularly when you see the young players. Like we mentioned, James McNabney getting his call up to the development side of the Irish squad last week. Another young player, for example, a lot of people were a bit disappointed to see him miss out on that development group is Jude Postlethwaite, who's really had to step up this season when James Hume has been out long term injured, now that Stuart McCluskey's out injured as well. And he's someone who's really grabbed that opportunity he's been given in the last few months.
Yeah, massively. I think even though they've obviously had a very difficult European Cup campaign, I think when you look at some of the players that they have, and you mentioned there, and Scott Wilson is another one, Neil. And you look at, I suppose, they play Zebre this weekend, right? So that's a 5-pointer, you'd imagine, right? So again, that will kick them up the table a little bit. The way their pack are starting to just grow, starting to get better week on week. Jimmy Duffy's obviously, working away there. The news yesterday that Dan Soper was moving into a new role, a transition type role, so a link between the academy and the senior team. The fact that he's got experience working under Richie, the fact that he's worked with the senior team for the last couple of years, he'll know exactly what attributes those young players need and be a great point of connection between the senior team and the academy. It probably opens up the spot for Mark Sexton to come in and see someone that Richie has worked with before. So you can see young players on the field really starting to stand up, get Richie starting to build his coaching staff and the structure that he feels they need to drive Ulster forward. And they're the second most powerful team in Ireland. Like, I think they've got more power athletes than Munster at the moment. And then anyone who watched Munster at Northampton, like, if you didn't know about Augustus before, like,
Yeah,
he,
just about to say, but
Yeah.
you know what I mean? Like, so Richie is setting up a team there. And it's not necessarily how they played with the Irish under 20s or whatever, but there's a lot of really dynamic ball carriers now with a good age profile, And Augustus is as good as anything in the URC at getting goal forward. So even though I've been hard on him and there's been some really dark days this year, I think that they're probably they have stability at the top, with the structure and Richie and him building his own staff. They've got some youngsters who have a lot of power and are exciting in a collision area. And they seem to know, they obviously have a great fan base, not too big a stadium, so you can get it full pretty quickly. And for me, that they're probably the province behind Leinster who have the most ducks in a row at the moment. Obviously, Munster have loads of potential and they've got some youngsters, Gleeson, etc. And they're probably better at the moment. And but just with the whole thing around uncertainty around coaching and things like that. And obviously Munster recruit started to recruit quite well with Dan Kelly and Milne and Lee Barron. But Ulster aren't in a bad place at all. They're not a bad place at all, particularly given how much power they seem to be developing, power athletes, and as Rich, Johnny said, starting to finish games a little bit better. And yeah, I think it's been a quick turnaround, really, given how dark it was when Richie came in.
Yeah, that's actually exactly what I was about to say next to that point was you bring it back to 12, like exactly 12 months ago when they had that really, really difficult loss away to Harlequins in the Champions Cup, and it built on for another month or so until they parted ways with Dan McFarland. I think if you had told Ulster fans 12, 11 months ago where they would be right now, I know it's not, you know, it's not worlds apart. They're obviously still building and there's still a lot of work to do, but I'd say they'd be reasonably pleased with the progress they've made. Final point on Ulster, Johnny. Cormac Isichuku was excellent again last Friday night. Would you be hoping, would you be expecting, I'm not saying for him to be playing every week for Ireland during the Six Nations, but would you be hopeful? Actually, no, I'll phrase it differently. Would you be disappointed if he didn't get a couple of games during the Six Nations?
Yeah, I would. I think because you look at the profile of, say, what himself and potentially himself and Ryan Baird could give you coming off the bench, you know, or the profile of, you know, you look at the profile of guys that he's going to be up against in, you know, Tom O'Hearn, Ryan Baird, like they're all like the physical capabilities and power and speed of those individuals. To be able to play six and second row, what those three guys, similar enough age profiles, what they're going to give as an extra, you know, those athletes are difficult to find. And when you have them, I think it's, you know, the opportunity to unleash them, you know, 20, 25, 30 minutes to go, it can be a real point of difference for what a bench can bring in terms of energy. And yeah, I think he's certainly done enough to be in that conversation potentially for that you know, bench spot. And he gives you something different to, you know, in terms of probably more raw speed in those wider channels if he finds himself out there, you know, compared to what Joe McCarthy or you know, James Ryan give you know, who are probably going to be your starters. So, yeah, I'd love to see him on that bench spot, in that bench spot, and unleashing him with, you know, 20, 25 minutes to go with a couple other guys that could really kind of transform a game, for you.
Bernard?
Just before we finish on Ulster, Dan McFarlane is now coaching. I didn't read much about that, but he's working with the Kobe Steelers underneath Dave Rennie and Mike Blair, and coaching Brody Retallick and Lo Mappe. So, just I never, I'm not sure if our listeners are aware of it, but yeah, that's where he went, and getting back in as an assistant coach, and obviously he would have known Dave Rennie from his time in Scotland when Dave Rennie was
Scotland.
coaching Glasgow. So yeah, it's interesting to see him, I suppose, continue his coaching career, and best luck to him.
I might just put that. I was about to put that Isichuku question over to you as well.
Sure.
Would you be hopeful? Again, I'm not saying like that he is the number 20 or number 19 in the Ireland squad every single week for these five games during the Six Nations. But would you be hoping that Simon Easterby would be open-minded, not to be picking probably that same 23 every week, to be rotating a couple of players in and out of that bench spot?
Yeah, I think so. I think we saw a bit of a focus on progression and long-term development in November, and I think it went well. Individuals stepped up, Cormac being one of them, and I would imagine he hasn't done anything but continue to impress with Ulster. So I would like to see him get an opportunity at some stage during the Six Nations for sure. I think he's got special talent, and yeah, getting more international experience is a great way of actually finding that.
Right, we'll move on to Franklin's Gardens, Northampton 34, Munster 32. the game of the round, quite possibly the game of the pool stage. It was a strange one, Bernard, where there was, like, I wrote a piece as well leading up to it about how this was a huge opportunity for Munster to go out and prove a point and get that home court or that home last 16 game, which they haven't had for a few years. They obviously didn't do it, but it was a strange feeling to come away from watching that match and actually feeling fairly positive about Munster. Ultimately, they were just beaten by the better team on the day, but they certainly went down swinging.
Yeah, there's been an energy about them recently, and it seems as if it's a happy squad. It seems as if they've kind of doubled down how they want to play. And I thought Ian Costello was very honest afterwards and said, "Look, when we're good, and when we're bad, we're very bad." And that's the killer for them to concede 32 points away from home, given that their actually defensive performance the week earlier was better. I think the problem for Munster now is it's different than they were conceding earlier on in the year. Particularly, like, the Zebre game was probably the worst example, but the best example, where the ruck D was really poor, in particular. The ruck chain defense was really poor in particular, and we've seen an improvement of that. So because Saracens were quite direct, because Ulster were very direct, there was no doubt that Munster were honest in their defence. You know, they were selfless. But the problem is against Northampton, we saw that if the team played to width, and we saw for one glimpse against Saracens when Saracens actually played, when they're chasing the game a little bit, and a few offloads, and then Munster were all over the place. So I thought they were quite narrow in their defence. Their backfield coverage for attacking kicks wasn't where it needed to be, and they got exposed. So that's the next step for, you know, it's all well and good having the energy and having the attacking game, which I think is, you know, ticking along nicely. But obviously they just need to make sure that they get better at conceding less tries more consistently, and also be able to defend against teams who have different attributes than Ulster had in that game, or that Saracens brought.
Johnny, it was like the crucial point was just that try before half time, because then you end up, they're a man down going into the second half. All of a sudden, they're going from 10 points up at half time to 3 points up. They've Gavin Coombs in the bin, and then all of a sudden, Northampton hit them in that third quarter. Now, in fairness, they did really, really well to come back for that final try, which, like, that try alone got them 2 points, and Jack Crowley comes up with a big conversion. But that probably was, I suppose, the winning and losing of the game.
And I think that just comes from kind of an extended period of pressure that, you know, they were on their final warning discipline wise, so it wasn't necessarily a high tackle for, you know, a yellow card for a high tackle. It was probably more just a continual you know, period of ill-discipline where they've already had their warning and off he goes. It was whether it, if it was someone who was offside, it would have been thing. But that just comes from that period of pressure. And then little things like cleaning up the seam of their line out. Gleeson and Scannell go for the right man in that, you know, for that try. Very simple, you know, a very simple basic play, but, you know, they kind of pincer together into one man, and then they get caught just playing that easy ball on the inside and the speed then. So it's those little things that, you know, I think that they need to be better on, that transforms them, because their attack, as Bert has already said, is in a really good space. But, you know, defense is probably what's going to transform them from, you know, quarterfinal, semifinals to being proper contenders, and they have to try and get that boxed off. And it starts with, you know, a lot of that starts with your first phase D, and then trying to manage what you can multi-phase. But yeah, I think that's certainly their biggest work on. But, like, they were in that. There was a proper old school tussle, and Franklin's Gardens, it'll be one of my favorite places to have played in terms of how close the crowd are to you. It's a brilliant surface. Yeah, it was a great game. But yeah, and they kept plugging, stayed in the fight in that 2 points. But yeah, I think Jack Crowley's that pass under pressure when you get the ball out the back to fire that was top notch.
Yeah, and that leads us nicely to the man himself. Like, I mean, the extra fun part, Bernard, is from a narrative point of view. Just as it was looking when we were starting to lock in Sam Prendergast forever into that number 10 jersey. Jack Crowley just waves at everyone and says, no, I'm not going anywhere, folks. He was absolutely outstanding on Saturday.
He's a super talent. He's got unbelievable mental toughness, fight, and it was just great to see. And in fairness to him, like, he suffered with Munster's lack of energy as well, and injuries and all that stuff. So, because I actually felt, I look back at some of the games pre the end of Graham, and like a lot of the things that Jack, the errors that Jack made were often errors made with really good intent. You know, he was nearly, he could sense the team struggling and tried to be the hero by making things happen. And you'd much prefer that in a player than someone who just goes missing, you know. So, but, you know, he definitely wasn't firing to the level that he has in the past. And that's difficult for an out half if the team aren't firing. But I think what you saw against Saints was Munster being in a good place. I know they conceded a lot of points, but being in a really good place, and him pulling the strings and showing, in particular, the attacking threat that he is. Like, he's a brilliant footballer. He attacks the line. He's got footwork. He's brave. He's got vision. So, really good performance for him. I don't think one performance, and the amount of people who were messaging me post, because that game was on before Leinster, you know, saying, oh, that's it now. Crowley starts for Ireland. I don't think it's as simple as that. And that's not saying he hasn't put himself forward in a meaningful way, absolutely. But I don't think Easterby or Farrell went into last Saturday going, right, whoever plays better between Crowley and Bradley. But fans seem to want that. Certain fans seem to want that. I don't think that's in any way the case. I think it's brilliant. We have two brilliant tens.
Yeah.
Both of them really good age profile. One more experienced than the other. But what I think we know is that both of them have a lot of talent. And from what we've seen with Jack at a senior level, he can step up to the big occasion. And Sam is going through that process. And so far, he's stepped up to all the different challenges. But he hasn't had as many challenges as Jack. So I think it's going to be an interesting debate.
Yeah, and I think that's why Saturday was really good for Sam. Like, yeah, in terms of, it was probably the first time that he was really, really, you know, put under pressure. And he'd, you know, a couple of, you know, sticky moments, but again, stays in it. Nice kind of offload for Simon's first try. And then, you know, a nice break then again for the second one, an offload. But like, it was in terms of lockdowns and the pressure that he was under, a really good opportunity for, you know, without sounding too kind of coachy, but like a really good opportunity for growth when he reviews that, particularly up against someone like Finn Russell. So that, again, that's really good, but comes after and with the pressure that Jack Crowley is creating in his own right. And, you know, there can be you know, and Leinster do it a bit. There can be a potential, I don't think they will do it, for it to potentially play both. And you look at what, in terms of how Leinster attack with multiple tens, and then, you know, Sam in behind the second pod off the 10 if they play off 9. And you can interlink both. Mm. And there is a potential to interlink both maybe in the last 20 minutes, like, you know, exactly like how Crowley did this weekend. But it's still a 50-50, and either whether you support blue or whether you support red, one side's going to be given out, whichever one doesn't play. But like, if someone does, if they pick Crowley first up, you go, well, yeah, that's no issue there, you know. So I think it's something that we can really enjoy that battle, and potentially also look for Ireland perspective that they could work really well together on the pitch, but also work well off the pitch and push each other really, really hard, and that's going to bring the best out of both of them.
Yeah, and like, we're less than 18 months on from the retirement of Johnny Sexton now, and we're talking about which of the two very, very good out halves are going to start. I think if you told us we'd be in this position after the 2023 World Cup, we'd have been absolutely delighted with that. One final Munster point, Bernard, just another player who I think has given Simon Easterby a lot to think about over the next couple of weeks is Calvin Nash. Two really, really well taken tries, and two very, very different tries. The first one, chasing down a lost cause, essentially. It was an excellent box kick from Conor Murray, obviously, identifying the space in behind and putting it the end over end way, so it's just going to trickle on. But, you know, Alex Mitchell and I can't remember who the other, it was Curtis Landon, sorry, was ahead of him.
Okay.
They had 10 plus metres on Calvin Nash to start and he beat them in a foot race. And then the second try, which was actually just such a wonderful try from start to finish, starting out in their own half on the other side of the pitch, working down. And you see Nash busting his balls to get across from one wing to the other to just get that ball on the loop around. He's really given Simon Easterby a lot to think about over the next couple of weeks, particularly with James Lowe not having played since November and obviously Mac Hansen's preparations being disrupted with his ban.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really hard one to leave him out, to be fair. You know, given the other two won't have played in Jan. Well, James Lowe might play, but how little they'll have played, and he's just bang on form. I mean, that performance, he's been really consistent for Munster, but that was just, you know, catch your breath and exciting. And I think that you mentioned that work off his wing and that sweep that Munster are doing. I mean, it's very Ireland, Andy Farrell like, and that's really important as well, because I think, you know, Connacht do have a similar type of philosophy. James Lowe is obviously very settled in that, and even though Nash has played for Ireland and played under it, just doing it on a weekly basis with your club just gets you the timing, you know, shows the coaches that it'll be an easy integration. I think he's right to be disappointed if he doesn't start against England. I think he, given Mac in particular being cold, obviously James Lowe, you'd probably take a punt on him just because of his kicking game.
That's
how important that is. Whereas with Mac, his form has been a little bit up and down anyway, and then obviously just won't have played for the weeks leading into it. So I think Nash has a great chance of starting.
It was a real, his second try was a real winger's try, like a real busy winger's try, multiple involvements. He's the last man on the right-hand side before they come around, like holding width, and then swings around, like really good. The other one is just out and out pace, also kind of smart. He stays in Mitchell's blind spot, and then you realize, and then when he pops up, you can see Mitchell go, "Oh shit, he's there." I think he should start in terms of the form that he's there with the preparation issues that the other two guys that you've already mentioned, Birch, that they've had. But yeah, it's good to see.
Yeah, I think that was actually the underrated highlight of the week, that behind the line shot of them chasing down. And you can see Alex Mitchell running along, kind of content with himself. But you can see the moment he realises he hasn't noticed Calvin Nash on his inside shoulder and his facial expression just changes in an instant. Right, we'll move it on to Leinster and Bath. Leinster 47-21 winners against Johan van Gran's side. Leinster ultimately run away with it, Bernard, in no small part probably to the red card. But for the first 40 minutes, was that the best we've seen a team navigate and, I suppose, drag open that Leinster defence?
Yeah, by a mile. And this is the challenge for Leinster. I think they'll actually have welcomed the opportunity to play against someone like Russell and the people around him who have a mixture of power and skill and pace. And I know that when Jacques was with the Springboks, the team that they really feared the most were the All Blacks. And obviously, the All Blacks are a hell of a team. But in terms of that defensive system, that the All Blacks have the X factor division to not shit themselves in the face of a blitz. Whereas you'll see on a regular basis, players look up, see it, and then just duck back in, and then Leinster are winning. So now, unfortunately for Bath, as they got more fatigued, they were less likely to be able to execute what they wanted to do. So you saw it when they were fresh. And effectively the ability to get wide channels, get run at Prendergast or Gibson Park on the edge or Gary, and then get all the way across to the other side, which was through a kick pass to Ollie Lawrence. And even though Ollie Lawrence was isolated, he was never going to do any damage. It gave them a chance to reset back to where they came from in a good shape and then obviously get there. So someone like Russell and his skill range and quality, will test Leinster's defence. And in fairness, they were spooked a bit at the start. They weren't sure. They weren't able to get that slow rook that they live off, and Bath capitalised on that. But what I liked actually was how Leinster just didn't really miss a beat. You know, all they needed was one entry into the 22, and they capitalised on that, and then they got confidence. And the challenge for Bath was, while they had a really good attacking game, and we'll talk about the scrum in a second, you never really believed that defensively they were able to stop Leinster. I didn't anyway. I just thought Leinster's power was too good for Bath, and that's the challenge. Now I do think that the likes of Toulouse or Toulon or La Rochelle, more so than Bordeaux, have that defensive density and capacity to be able to not let Leinster score every time they enter the 22. So that's something. But look at Leinster will have they'll appreciate the opportunity they've had to be tested in a different way, I think, and still come out, you know, with a bonus point win.
Would you say, like, Johnny, would part of the way Bath exposed them defensively, like, when, I suppose, with the benefit of hindsight, are you looking at it going, there's four centres playing across that three-quarter line? You've Jamie Osborne and Gary Ringrose in the wings.
Yeah.
You've got Robbie Henshaw and Jordy Barrett in the centre. I know some of that was obviously dictated by injuries and stuff like that, and it gave them an opportunity to experiment. Would you expect a Leinster defence to be a little bit more better with, I suppose, your traditional wingers, with James Lowe back in the team, with a Jordan Larmour, with Jimmy O'Brien out on the right side of the pitch?
Yeah, I think potentially, yeah, because you can kind of just get a bit stuck, and you know, Osborne for the first try, Ringo's just kind of get caught slightly on his heel, just picking the wrong man. Same for the one then the left hand side. I think it's their last try, is it, with Osborne? So yeah, it's just those reads, but a lot of that also comes from, I think Birch has already said it, but not being able to slow the ball down, which then means you can't get your spacings across the line to then get forward. And a lot of that, if you don't get spaces on your inside, your wingers are kind of like literally all duck or no dinner. And if they shoot in, they're shooting in past the 15. And if they don't stop the ball, they look really silly. But then if they don't shoot in and they stay in the 15 and the spacings are too wide, then they're leaving holes either side for them to go to because they're stuck on their heels a bit. So a lot of that comes down to kind of the interior D and how, you know, you can slow the ball down to allow you get that spacing. And, you know, a big thing, multiple nines, speed of ball, it's kind of for a team to be able to attack like Bat did in the first half for 80 minutes, the ruck has to be on point all the time. You really need one bullet, one kill, and then be able to the second man, or you have to have a nine that's so quick that can just play the ball instantly. Where if you send two guys or three guys, two guys past the ball, one guy over, you're losing your numbers to feet then to attack that space, and it's also slower. So you kind of, it's a double-edged sword defensively then, because you're not getting your spacings right to then shoot hard in the 15 and allow wingers make those decisions. So yeah, it comes from kind of both areas, but they managed it well. They were so clinical from an attack perspective that they were okay. And then sure, the power coming off the bench is just absolutely insane. You know, you look at what Sneijman gives them, what Salam he gives them. You know, they're just that power. The red card probably does kill the game. Birch, being there, do you think the ref just kind of gave it and then went in his mind, yeah, oh crap, I didn't realise, you know, it was probably one where he should have penalised him and go, you're on a yellow card, cop on, and then he probably gets taken off. But it was one where I felt watching on TV, it was like, he blew the whistle, pulled the card out and then went, oh shit, I've kind of, what was it like there?
Yeah, I was shocked. I realised when he realized when he gave the yellow what he was going to have to do. He followed the letter of the law. Like, I haven't seen it before. Johan afterwards, you know, in a non-emotional way, kind of just said, look, we've never seen that before. And I'm sure when they review the game on Monday, they'll be trying to see, could they have heard on the ref mic a warning, you know, could they have got him off just before that? It reminds me, years ago, I played a match in the sports ground. and I was captain of Connacht, and I won't mention the prop's name, but basically he'd given away about five penalties in the first half. And as I was walking off to go into the dressing room, Nigel Owens, the referee, said to me, "Look, if that fella comes out the second half, I'm gonna have to send him a yellow card, him, right?" So I said to Michael Bradley, I said, "Look, another's in trouble here." So he went to have a word with him, and the prop was like, "No, don't worry, I have it. I leave it. It's okay. It's okay." Right. So Brad said to me, "Look, we'll give him a few minutes." So anyway, we have a scrum on the far side, which is where the stand is, couple minutes into the second half. And I said, "Right," I said, "just keep this one up, whatever." He was my tight end. And we go straight to ground, and I can see Nigel Owens looking at me, and he's like, what's going on, whatever. And next thing, Nigel Owens gets it in his ear, number three green is going off, whatever. So the prop in question looks over at the sub coming on, and he puts his hand up and goes, "Oh, it's okay, it's okay," whatever. So basically, the prop doesn't come on, and Nigel Owens is going like, "What's going on?" And I said, "I don't know, whatever." So anyway, he says, "Right, we're getting on with it. Look, we're getting on with the scrum." So I just said to the prop beside me, I said, "Look, it, whatever you do, do not collapse this." Of course, he goes, no, don't worry, whatever." Anyway, crouch, touch, pause, engage, bang, straight to ground, whatever. I said, head in the muck. I'm going, "Oh no!" So get up, of course. Nigel Owens takes out the yellow card. Your man is yellow carded, and we end up having to go down to 14, and they score, I think, 10 points, I think, during the 10 minutes. And another didn't play again for a few weeks. Let's put it that way.
I admire the confidence because
Yeah,
there's
no,
because
unfortunately,
there's
Collins wasn't
something
the problem, but yeah.
so demoralizing about being involved in a match or in a scrum when you know your opposition player just has you on toast. And that's what Bath had on Saturday with Ben Obano and with Francois Van Wijk, who obviously came on for a little bit while Obano was in the bin to begin with as well. And I think there were four Leinster scrum penalties. I'm almost certain all four of them came on the Rabah Slimani and the Bath Loosehead side of the scrum, which leads me nicely to I'm just going to open the floor. Talk about Rabah Slimani for us, Bernard.
Yeah, I regret. So Donald would pick man of the match, but he was beside me, and he wrote down a few names, I picked Henshaw. But leaving the stadium, I was like, what was I doing? I mean,
You picked.
if
I was ready to blame Donal Lennon for all of this, Bert.
I take shared responsibility for it. But like, I'm good with myself that I didn't think of Rabah during the game, because realistically, will he ever get player of the match for Leinster? You'd have to do like he's not gonna be scoring two or three tries, you would think. And that was the chance to give it to him and reward him, because it probably was the key factor in the demise of Bath. Afterwards, I thought, I agree with you, Van Wijk didn't do great, but could Bath have moved the twa over to Loosehead? Just it was so bad. It was so bad on that side, and he can't play both sides. That might have been something that they regret. But the reality is Rabah has just found a lot of he just found his place now in this Leinster team, whether it's off the bench or starting. And I know the Bristol game round one was very messy.
It did take him it like to go back, like it did take him a few games to settle in because there's obviously a different interpretation of scrums between France and URC. So
No,
like you can see how he's just kind of altered his approach over the last few months.
you know what it was? It was the Ulster game away, where I felt that was the turning point for him. And I was up there, and I was pitch side. So and there was a French TV crew following him to do a piece for BEN and ever. And they had a guy just basically following on the sideline, just scrum cam on him. And afterwards, they were showing me the clips. So even when I didn't have a good look at it from where I was or the TV camera angle, I saw like a scrum cam. And what the simplest way of describing it is, he's become much more patient, right? So Rabah was one of the most instructive scrummagers ever in the top 14. When he was in Stade Francais, Clermont spent big money on him. He came in and he was dominant for a while, but then he started to really feel the wrath of referees and assistant referees. So because he was so good at just getting into that pocket of space between the hooker and the loose head. And it was interesting. I think it was a Ty Furlong was talking about his body shape and just saying that he has unbelievably narrow shoulders, right? Which is which sounds like it wouldn't be a great thing to have as a prop. But in actual fact, if you have a lot of strength and you're not afraid of pain, and you're built like Rabah, the shoulders actually help him because he gets into that spot. Like, look, it's not a wide space, or whatever, but he can actually get his head and the shoulders into that nook or cranny between the hooker and the loose head. And obviously, hookers are trying to keep him out of there, but it's very difficult. And what he's doing at the moment is he's not unbelievably explosive. Like we see an Oxenishe, and it's explosive power. He just lets it build, and he gives his body shape and gives a perfect platform for the transfer of power, his own power plus the back five, if that makes sense. And then he just waits, and then as soon as the loose head moves a foot or just tries to change an angle to try and get more comfort, bang, it's just that power then just goes through, and then you see them going backwards or going up or going around. And look, Leinster, since Robin McBride came in, Leinster have been a lot more aggressive at scrum time, right? And now I wouldn't say it's actually worked that well for them because they haven't always had dominance. Ironically, they actually had dominance in the final last year against Toulouse, which
they win a lot of scrum penalties, but they also concede a lot of scrum.
Yeah, they concede a lot. Whereas at the moment, in the last few weeks, I think they're starting to show less vulnerability in terms of giving away penalties and better outcome in terms of winning them. And look, obviously Tighe will come back and start if he's fit, but you know, having the, or look, maybe Leinster would do the Andrew Porter sub thing with that. You know, like realistically, if you think that Rabah can get you scrum dominance the first 30, or wear down a loose head, and then you have your Furlong, you know, a Porter on the field at the end, you know, with RG Snyman and Jordy Barrett, etc. I mean, when the opposition aren't as strong as they had been at the start or fatigued, that's something that they may look at. But certainly at the moment, he's you know, absolutely loving it. The players love him. He's given him a different tool, weapon, and it had a key factor in that win the other night.
We do have to move it on into the last few minutes because we do need to talk about Connacht. Obviously, four bonus point wins out of four in their Challenge Cup pool. They have a home round of 16, home quarter final, home semi final for as long as they stay in the tournament. Cardiff again in the round of 16. But Johnny, how realistic is it for Connacht to be able to go all the way in this Challenge Cup? How realistic are they as contenders for the competition?
I think if they can keep a full bill of health, then yeah, I think they have a good opportunity. JJ being back, you know, I think Boyle of, you know, he's been in incredible form, you know, all season. His carries, he's been really explosive and dynamic. He's a big ball carrier, big player for them. Scored again this, you know, this weekend. You know, do you look, if they go, does it, could it potentially set a semi-final up in Mayo? Imagine that, like, yeah, you know, you know, there. Like, and there is a, there's a revenue perspective there that I'd say everyone in the office is looking at going, let's get to a semi-final, let's try and sell, you know, let's try and sell another one out. So I think they do. I think with how they play attackingly, again, you know, Sexton's influence on Mark's influence on them, they're a brilliant team to watch. They can manage now this period very well, have a full bill of health, and get going in this competition. I think it's fair with their draw to really put down a marker and potentially have a really good crack off this. And depending on how the league goes, this could be their win and their in shot if they did get there. But I think there's a lot at play for Connacht to really give this a proper go both on and off the pitch, from a financial perspective, it could be really, really good for them with the way the draw has gone their way.
Yeah, and Bernard, like, I suppose it's one of those things now where there's a big carrot there, but to be honest, they can't even really think about it for the next few weeks, because they've Glasgow away, which is a tough game. It might be the worst time to be getting Glasgow, obviously, though,
yeah,
leading
Scotland
into Six
away.
Nations, where they're going to be missing players in Scotland camp. Cardiff at home, Benetton at home, Ospreys away, leading up to that Munster game at McHale Park in Castlebar. There's a run of winnable games there, and if they can pick up three or four wins out of those four games, they're back in a decent position. I know they still have to go to South Africa later on in the season as well, but it's about forgetting about the Challenge Cup now for the next few weeks.
Yeah, they've bounced back from that Ulster debacle with obviously a strong win against the Lions and a really good performance against Cardiff. This is a huge game from this away win against Glasgow would in some way make up for the missed opportunity against against Ulster. And I know in the top 14, it's always been part of the mindset of if you have a setback, if you lose a game you've kind of banked on winning, you got to get it back quickly. And the fact that Glasgow will be missing a lot of players is an opportunity for that. And that would be huge, because as you said, they have to go to South Africa later on. But like the Munster game, the fact that it's been moved, you know, there'll be an emotional edge to that there. You imagine it'd be a special occasion and
sold out as well already.
Exactly. So JJ being back is obviously a big boost to them. So, but I want to see them. I want to see them be more consistent. I don't, my eyes and my ears tell me don't trust Challenge Cup form, because there's teams desperate to get out of that competition as much as teams desperate to get through it. So let's just see now what they're like on a weekly basis in the URC. Before I'm going to wait before I really believe in them again.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point. So Glasgow away for Connacht on this Friday night, 7:35. Kickoff time for that game against Cardiff in the Challenge Cup is confirmed as well. I gave out the Champions Cup ones earlier, but Connacht and Cardiff is 8 p.m. on Saturday, the 5th of April, at the Dexcom Stadium in Galway, and the winner of that game will take on either Perpignan or Racing 92. They also kick off at the same time on that Saturday evening. Fellas, that's where we'll leave it. Thanks a million for everything.
Just one thing, Niall, I forgot to mention the Ulster game, Neil. I forgot to mention Niall Armstrong, who played nine for Exeter this weekend, back from injury. He's an Ulster homegrown player. Spent a bit of time over New Zealand, then got signed up over there. So he's kind of flying the flag for us lads that did the kind of road less travel, like myself and Birch back in the day. So he's been out with a shoulder injury for a while. It's good to see him back in the mix, and you know, puts himself playing a home province, gives him an opportunity to potentially see what's what. But he's doing great over in Exeter, and hopefully he can kick on a bit now with a bit of injury free time.
Yeah, fair play to me, Jack Dunn and Martin Maloney over there as well, two fellas who've also taken that road. A reminder, Dragons against Munster in the URC on Saturday evening, 7:15 p.m. on RT2 and RTE Player this weekend. And also you can watch Ulster and Zebra in the URC on Sunday from 5 p.m. on RT2 and RTE Player as well. Johnny and Bernard, thanks a million. We'll speak to you again soon.
Cheers, lads.